together. We are birds of a feather. We got to come together, 'cause we are birds of a feather. We got to come together, 'cause we are birds of a feather. Or there will never be, Lord of mercy, no love at all. There will never be, yeah, yeah, no love at all. We also got to realize we are one people. Yeah, we got to realize that we are one people. Yeah, we got to
good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Saturday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, on recording, an interview with Sherry Tepper, one of the greats in science fiction, and of course, some fundraising. Stay tuned. Thank you.
King George's men came marching up to the olden door. They said no word to the landlord, they drank his ale instead. But they gagged his daughter and bound her to the foot of her narrow bed. Two of them knelt to the casement with muskets at the side. There was death at every window, hell at one dark window. For Bess could see through the casement the road that he would ride. They had tied her up to attention with many a sniggering jest. They had bound a musket beside her with a bow beneath the breast. Now keep good watch, and they kissed her. She heard the dead man say, "Look for me by the moonlight, watch for me by the moonlight. I come to thee by the moonlight, though hill should bar the way." She twisted her hands behind her with all the knots in good. She writhed her hands till her fingers were wet with sweat and blood. They stretched and strained in the darkness, and the hours crawled by like years. Till now when the stroke of midnight called on the stroke of midnight, the tip of her finger touched it, the trigger at least was hers. Were they deaf, they did not hear. Down the ribbon of moonlight, over the brow of the hill, the highwayman came riding, riding, riding. The redcoats looked to the priming, she stood up straight and still. Tod-lot in the frosty silence, tod-lot in the echoing night. Nearer came and nearer, her face was like a light. Her eyes grew wide for a moment, she drew in a last deep breath. Then her finger moved in the moonlight, her musket shot at the moonlight. Shattered her breast in the moonlight, and wound him with a dare. He turned his spur to the west, he did not know she stood. But with her head of a musket, drenched with her own red blood. Not till the dawn he hooded, his face grew gray to hear. Ah, there's the landlord's daughter, the landlord's black-eyed daughter, had watched for love in the moonlight and died in the darkness there. And back he spurred like a madman, shrieking a curse to the sky, with a white road smoking behind him and his Arabia brandished high. Blood red were the spurs of the golden moon, wine red was his velvet coat. When they shot him down on the highway, down like a dog on the highway, and he lay in his blood on the highway with a bunch of lace at his throat. Thank you.
bit of noise. That is Alfred Noyes, as interpreted by Lorena McKennitt, The Highwayman. A lovely, lovely version. Indeed. Her version and Phil Oakes's version of the epic poem, not epic poem, but narrative poem, are both, you know, fabulous renditions, very different, and both, I think, very true to what the poem is supposed to be about. And I had spent last night, those who were listening last week know that we were giving away tickets, and I was attending Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers at Radio City Music Hall. And there's a performance tonight. I went last night. And this is where the orchestra is playing at, as I have said on the air before. It's not so much the idea of watching the movie at Radio City, which is always nice. It's the idea that you've got over 300 people who are performing this, this fabulous score by Howard Shore in front of you, and you get to partake of it. You get to enjoy it and see it in a whole other way. It's a little disconcerting at first when you're watching a movie and you're just engrossed in the movie, and then your eyes go down below the screen and you realize everything that you're hearing, all the sound that you are hearing, is coming from that stage. The singers, the soloist, and you begin to realize what goes into that. And the fact that this is, when they make the movie, of course, they get to do retakes, they loop the thing and all that. It was fabulous. It was fun. And, of course, Lorena McKennitt's music is very apropos to a lot of the themes. More so Fellowship of the Ring than The Two Towers, but still, it matches certain moments in there and just the whole feel. And so I felt, why not? It's got a lovely feel to it. And I like it. We played it. I hope you enjoyed it as well. This is WBAI in New York City. Listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. It is October, which on this program usually means it is reserved for fantasy programming, what I like to call fantasy for a spell. But that it will not be that way this month, for we did it last week. We had the fabulous and wonderful Karen Lord on this program. And if you did not hear that, but you must, you must. I recommend hasten thee to archive.wbai.org, or actually you can just go to my site, ourwolf.com. And that's HOURWOLF.com. And click on listen to this program link, and that will take you to the WBAI archive, which will specifically be my two most recent shows. And right now, that would be just going off now, because it goes exactly 2 weeks, Nalo Hopkinson and Karen Lord. And those were both, if I say so myself, fine, fine interviews. And this morning, we have another. But Sherry S. Tepper, is really more of a hard science fiction writer, and many would call her an eco-feminist writer. And, you know, I am not prepared this morning. But let me tell you what's going to be coming up. This is, obviously, if you've been listening, a fundraising drive. And the way we do fundraising drives here in most recently, that is to say over about the last year, type up something so I can have it in front of me as I talk to you. Ah, there we are. The way we have been doing it most recently is, well, we get preempted a lot. And that is going to happen. But our program director was very kind. In 2 weeks, I would he had me on this week for pitching, and in 2 weeks for pitching with recorded programs in between. This did not work, because in 2 weeks I'm going to be away at Capclave, which is a science fiction convention held in Washington, D.C. And I asked if I could swap, because also that would not have put me on the air on October 30th. And we know October 30th is Halloween, or at least the day before. It's Halloween weekend, and as a result, I very, very much want to be on the air. And he said no problem and allowed me to swap. Now, this reminds me that something else I have to get up on this computer. I have to get up announcement, because my next event at the New York Review of Science Fiction reading is going to occur before I have the opportunity to tell you about it. I'm not going to be on the air between now and then. And I don't even have this stuff out there. Hold on one moment. Let me see if I can Google it up. Haven't put any of this out on the internet yet to my mailing list or anything like that, but no. Okay. But we will tell you about it. Oh my God, what is with this? It's John Lennon's 70th birthday. That's why I'm seeing all these wonderful, bizarre images. Okay, well, anyway. So let's deal with a few things. Number one, that will be Tuesday, October 26th. And Terrence Taylor, who avid listeners of this program are familiar with, has put together just an incredible, wonderful evening. This will be a special event. Usually we are the first Tuesday of every month. This time we're doing a special. And it will be on Tuesday the 26th in time for Halloween. And it will be Beyond Blackula. All black writers writing of vampires. We will have for you. Now, pardon me. I am doing this from memory. I will repeat this later and give you bios and tell you all a little bit about each person. But in no particular order whatsoever, we will have Leslie Banks, a.k.a. L.A. Banks, quite the bestseller in her vampire hunter books or huntress books, and she does werewolf stuff as well, but we'll be dealing with the vampiric stuff. Alaya Dawn Johnson, who I hope and trust most of you have heard on this program, and if I hope you've read her novels and short stories. She's fabulous, and she has a vampire novel set in the 1920s with flappers in the jazz era. You know, what more can you want there? Moonshine, you know, let's think about Prohibition, vampires, moonshine. It's all exceedingly clever. The fabulous, wonderful Linda Addison will be reading some of her poetry relating to vampires. And, of course, Terrence Taylor, author of Bite Marks, and that series of books. So again, that will be the New York Review of Science Fiction special Beyond Blackula. October 26th, admission is free. We will be asking a donation at the door. It will be crowded. I can promise you that. Get there early. If you want more information, well, get on my mailing list. I don't share it with anybody. It's discreet. Not to worry. Send an email to Jim at OurWolf.com, HOURWOLF.com, and you'll be sure to get notification of that and whatever other readings I'm doing. I send out approximately one, sometimes two emails a month, so it's very light traffic. This last Tuesday, by the way, our reading at the New York Review of Science Fiction readings with Seanan McGuire and Kat Valenti was not underattended. We counted a little over 80 people, which is really nice in a place that has a capacity of about 60, and at least as far as chairs are concerned. People were happy to stand in the back, and we got everybody in, but it was very gratifying to see all those people there, and a fine reading it was. I'm sorry you weren't there, but of course we did record it and filmed it, so your opportunity to hear what transpired will occur. Okay, so fundraising, pitching, and program. We're going to combine all of those this morning. And we're going to start with the content. We're going to start by playing for you an interview with a writer who I have not before interviewed. She doesn't get to New York a lot, but is somebody who I have read for years and admired for years. And I will read you a little bit of her biography from Wikipedia. Her name, the name that she is best known as, at least within science fiction and horror, is Sherry Tepper, Sherry S. Tepper, probably known as an eco-feminist writer, or as they say here, feminist science fiction writer, often with an eco-feminist slant. Born in Littleton, Colorado, for most of her career, she worked for the Rocky Mountain Planned Parenthood. You know what? She talks about much of this during the interview. So I'm realizing that there's actually not a lot that I have to say. It will transpire in there. Her writing, pardon, is, well, as we say, eco-feminist. It is not the kind of thing that will stop you from reading it, though. It is not shrill. I especially like her mysteries, by the way. They're not the science fiction genre, but they're a great deal of fun. And it was a pleasure and an honor to be able to interview her. And, if you pledge during this program a minimum of $75 to WBAI, you can get an autographed copy of her brand new novel, The Waters Rising. And that is a nice deal. I gotta get it out of my bag here. Here we go. Lovely cover. You all see it? There it is. Hefty book. You can hear it. And this is, of course, a hardcover. And EOS, E-O-S, which is an imprint of HarperCollins, soon to become Voyager Books. They are changing their name. They were Avon Books, basically. And 10 years ago, approximately, became EOS Books, and now are going to become more of an international company, and as such become Voyager Books. And they have donated to WBAI 10 copies of this novel, which were mailed to Sherry in New Mexico, where she lives on the ranch that she works at, and I believe actually co-owns or owns. And, she's in Santa Fe. That's correct. And then they were mailed by her to WBAI. And we are very grateful for this gracious and lovely donation. And I hope that you will be grateful as well. And I'm going to talk about that a little later, but I'm going back to the old theory of, you know what, I'm going to give you a program. I'm going to give you a good program. And I'm going to tell you about the other good programs that I have tried to provide for you over these airwaves and that other people provide for you over these airwaves, and you're going to pledge. And in exchange for that pledge, we're going to give you stuff. Now, initially, we were going to have a reading to go along with this, but given the pitching and some technical issues that occurred, I was given the option of reading from the book myself, but I am not going to do that this morning. We're going to raise money. We're going to do our thon thing. And I will do another program with a slightly longer version of this interview and with a complete reading to go along with it, preferably by Sherry. So, this morning, however, $75 pledge, get a copy, an autographed copy of The Waters Rising by Sherry Tepper. Ah, give a $100 pledge and we will toss in a CD of the interview and perhaps some audio bonuses. So that's the deal for this morning. And hey, want to take it on faith? Want to take it on trust? And there's only 10. These are collector's items, therefore. Call right now, 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950. And as I say, $75 pledge to WBAI will not only make you a subscriber to WBAI, but you'll get a copy of The Waters Rising by Sherry S. Tepper. Okay. I think that is enough, at least to promote the idea of starting this interview. And we will see if it happens interrupted or not, because this is the only time that I'm on until October 30th. And that means we're going to need to be successful to raise money, to meet the goal, to keep this radio station alive. 212-209-2950. Take it on faith. Call early. And, well, less issues later. At any rate, we will now begin that. Oh, yes, I didn't. This is something I rarely do. I rarely do phone interviews. It's something not common for me. But I thought Sherry Tepper was a good exception. As I say, she's not likely to be coming to New York in the very near future. She is 81 years old and working at the guest ranch she operates every day. So I figured, yeah, we'll do the phone this time. We'll make that exception. And it worked out better than I thought. There will be a bit of awkwardness in the back and forth, and you will hear, oh yeah, I better put this into mono, it occurs to me, because it's otherwise in what they call distinct channels. So I'm going to put it into mono, and that way everything will sound a little bit better. All right, enough, Jim. Time to play the interview, and we'll be back. Possibly before we all know it.
I guess the best place to begin is by asking you how you began.
I began.
Yeah, how did you start writing? What was it that you were writing? All that
good
stuff.
Can I give you a little biography?
Absolutely.
Well, I think a little interview will kind of lead into it and lead up to the whys and the wherefores that you're looking for.
Okay.
I have four major incidents in my younger years that kind of formed where I went and what I write about and what I think about, okay? And the first of these happened when I was 4 years old. And my grandmother was my caregiver. My mother was really not very interested in taking care of children, so my grandmother, who lived with us, my mother's mother, kind of took care of us, and she was the major person in my life. We lived out in the country. There were no other children. I never saw another young person, another child, until the first day of school. And so my grandmother announced to me one day, sort of out of the clear blue sky, "You're going to have a baby brother." And this was well before the time when youngsters were encouraged to pat mommy's rounded belly and feel the baby kick and know where the baby was coming from.
Right.
This was clear out of the sky. And she was it in my life. And so I said to her, and I, as I recall, quite concerned about it, but, "Nana, I'll still be your grandbaby, won't I?" And she said, I've got a grandson now. I don't need you anymore.
Oh, my God.
That's it, you know. And I don't recall crying. I think I just sort of was in shock for a long, long time. Okay, now the second episode that I remember very vividly happened when I was 16. My parents asked me where I was thinking of going to school after I got out of high school. And I mentioned the name of the school, which I understood had a marvelous creative writing course. Now, let me explain why that was important. We lived clear out in the country. As I said, there were no other children. I was taken to school in the morning, picked up in the afternoon, so there was very little social life. So my life was lived through books. My father went to an office where a bookmobile came every Friday, and he told the librarian to please set aside 10 books for his daughter. And every Friday, 10 books went back and 10 new books came. So from the time I was 8 years old until well up in life, I was reading 10 books a week, every single week. And I don't think he ever told her how old his daughter was, and he never told her what kind of books. So there was just books. But, you know, you fasten on the ones that fascinate you, and they were the fantasy books. And they were the science fiction books. And when I found out about science fiction magazines later, I begged please to be given science fiction magazines. So this went on. And when I was about 16, they asked me where I wanted to go to school. And I mentioned, as I said, this school that had this wonderful creative writing course. Oh, no, 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 you can't go there. No, that's too far for a girl to go away from home. I can't think of that. No, what are you, silly? You don't know how to live on your own. So that was the second incident. They sent me to a junior college for women that had no creative writing course, and where the work was very similar to what we'd done in high school. It was, in essence, a nice, safe place for farmers to deposit their daughters for a couple of years after high school before they got married. And that was sort of the prevailing thought. You know, that's what you were going to do. And I did. And I got married, and I had the requisite 2 children. And when 4 years after I was 16, when I was 20, when my brother was asked where he wanted to go to school, he mentioned the same school I had. Of course, son. Of course.
Mm-hmm.
That's episode number 2. So here I was with 2 children and a marriage that did not work. And how could it have? You know, it was one of those things one fell into because it was expected of one. And so I needed to go to work and support the 2 children that I had. So I went down to the Colorado Bureau of Employment, where they gave you tests, a full day of tests to find out what you were suited to do. And there were some, you know, manual dexterity tests and writing things and speaking things and all kinds of different things that they did all day. And late in the afternoon, I sat on one side of the desk, and the interviewer and counselor sat on the other side of the desk. And he made these very revealing comments like, yes, and then finally put his hands, palms down on top of the stack of papers, looked me in the eye and said, God, I wish you were a man. You'd have made a great sheet metal worker.
Oh, my God.
This was incident number 3. I found a job. I went to work for CARE Incorporated. It was just a straight clerical job. There was not a lot required of it. You know, elementary intelligence at a high school graduation was fine. And I worked for them. It was mainly a fundraising office, you know, and a publicizing office.
For international relief?
Yeah, for international relief. And this was, you know, not that long after World War II, so there was a lot of hunger in the world and a lot of people sending care packages to people and relatives overseas and so forth. And a lot of little speech giving and just, you know, that kind of thing. So for 7 years, I did this in Denver and lived in Denver. And the money just wasn't there. They weren't paying me zilch. I mean, you know, and you have 2 kids, it's hard. And so I decided to look for another job. And I interviewed for a job with Planned Parenthood. Everybody knows what Planned Parenthood is. And again, it was just a regional office to run their regional office and where their clinics were and so forth. And they hired another woman. They didn't hire me. They hired an older woman who had been a lobbyist, and I guess they thought that would help, which it would have if she'd stuck with it. But she lasted only 90 days, so then they turned to their second choice, which was me. And I called the Office of Care in New York and said, I'm giving you my resignation. What would you like me to do? And they said, no, I'll get some candidates and call us and tell us about them, and we'll tell you who to hire. Well, there were only two, really, that applied for the job. It didn't pay zilch. One was a woman pretty much in my position, where she had a couple of kids to support. The other was a retired Army major on full retirement pay with a wife working full-time and no children. And I called and told my boss that these were the candidates, and he said to me, and I quote precisely, hire the major and offer him so much. I know that's more than we've been paying you, but he's a man. This was incident number four.
Yeah, and while some of those other incidents may have changed through the years, incident number four is still an ongoing issue in society today.
I was amazed thereafter to talk to girls who had been encouraged to go to the schools and, of their choice, and encouraged to learn and encouraged to do what they wanted to do. And, you know, that your family let you do, oh, they told me to, they sent me there, they, you know, things of this kind. So all of this kind of formed the opinions that you find in my writing. And during all of this, I was still reading 10 books a week, and it was all science fiction and fantasy. I couldn't live the life I wanted in my own world. So by God, I lived it in somebody else's. Does that explain?
It does a great deal. Now, how much of that was dystopian, and how much of it was where you wanted to go? And
well, I read what I got. You know, I got all the magazines, and there was some of each. You know, there was a lot of one thing and a lot of another. I didn't like the dystopian ones terribly. I don't like hopelessness. You know, we've got enough hopelessness and pain in our lives. I don't really think that I need to dwell in that, you know. So of the two, I think I did not like the dystopian ones. Mm-hmm. Not much. Anyhow, I wrote things, little things, and I sent them off. And a few of the magazines, I think I sold one short story that's lost in the mists of time. I don't even remember the title of it or what magazine, but there was one that was sold. And I sold some verses, and Fred Pohl was an editor, and he picked up some of my verses and published them. They were silly things, just little science fiction-y sagas in verse. And nothing much else, because really there wasn't a lot of time. And time went by, and time went by. And I got to be in my 40s, and I said to myself, if you're ever going to write, you got to do it. And it's time to just take the bit in your teeth and write a book. And so I did. And my name for it was A Remnant in Orana, and that's what I sent it in as. And it was pre-computer. So that meant every time I changed something, I had to retype, you know, practically the whole thing, and it was 700 pages long. The labor involved, I'm telling you about the labor involved.
Right.
Here. Yeah. And so I sent it off in the box, and I had the postage that went with it to send the box back to me. And I sent it to one of the publishing houses that said they took and considered manuscripts from unpublished authors. And then I sat back and I waited, and I waited, and I waited, and 6 months went by. And I grew angry. And I called them up, and I spoke to the editor who read those particular things, and I said, you know, at least you should have the courtesy to send it back. That represents a lot of labor. And this little voice, who sounded like it came out of, you know, freshman high school or maybe seventh grade, and I said, this girl's about a third of as old as I am. Oh, that was rather well written. but it was much too long and sad for an unknown author. Could you show me something more accessible? I said, yes, and please send it back. So I went into the typewriter and I typed the first four chapters of King's Blood 4 without stopping. I put it in an envelope and sent it to her. And she called me up and she said, finish it. Give me two more like that and I'll publish the first one.
Great. So that was when exactly?
That was The Revenants in 1980. It was published in 82, and this would have been about 1980.
And that was through Ace Books?
Yeah, Ace Books, paperback, right. And the one that I wrote that she liked was King's Blood 4, followed by Necromancer 9 and Wizards 11, and then they were republished in hardback as The True Game. And
yeah, I actually have the edition of The True Game.
Do you?
Yeah.
You know, I just reread it. It's pretty good. I'd forgotten all about it.
Yeah,
it's not bad a bit.
That's the scary thing. When you go back and read the things that you loved X many years ago and you try to find out, well, it's now 15 years later. Did it, oh my God, 25
Honey,
years later.
30 years.
Yeah.
Well, it's 30 years since I wrote that.
That's right.
I was 53 when I was first published. I'm now 81 years old.
Wow, okay. So there's hope for me yet because I'm 55, so maybe
you
one
can.
Of these years.
Oh, you can. Don't give up. No, don't put it off. Pitch in there. So then that's how it all started. Okay.
That's great. So over time, you began writing different things. You started with genre, science fiction, fantasy, and all that. But you have never really stood still in the kinds of things that you write, have you?
Well, I was forced out of it. Now, I can tell you how that happened.
Please.
I was writing these things very rapidly. I mean, I wrote two books in 83 were published, and two in 84, and two in 85, actually three in 85. Four in 85. I had the two Mavin Manyshape books, and then I had one Mary Ann book. And then my then agent suggested that I try something creepy. And so I wrote something called Blood Heritage, which I guess is horror. I didn't think of it so at the time, but it's called horror. And then we had done so well with Mavin Manyshape that when in there I wrote the Mary Ann book, one of the first Mary Ann books. There were three of those. But they were fantasy. And somewhere, it was shortly after that, I'd written a couple of those in the three Ginian books that I decided to settle down and try to write something hardcover. See, these were all paperbacks.
Yeah.
All of them up to that point. So in about 85, I settled down and I really started to write something that I hoped would be a good hardcover book, and that was The Awakeners.
Uh-huh.
And it was published in two books. It was written as one book. It wasn't written as two. It had two sections, but it was written as one book. And I say this only because I was criticized later for the first one because it didn't finish up. And I knew it hadn't finished up, but it wasn't my decision to publish it in two volumes. Anyhow, then the next thing I did after that was The Gate to Women's Country. And that was our hardcover Doubleday. Okay. And then my agent called me and he said, they don't want any more of these little books, the little paperback books.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want any more of these. I said, well, why not? Well, because now that you've written a couple of these hardcover books, your fans will expect this. And I said, well, put somebody else's name on them. No, they don't want them. It's fantasy. The same people will read it and they'll know it's you. I said, all right, what about I write something else? Now, the reason for this was that I got stuck on the big books. I had a rule where I had to write 5 pages a day, every day. Didn't matter if I had to throw them all away the next day. You could not quit for the day unless you'd written at least 5 pages.
Yeah, this is the old Samuel Johnson rule, isn't it?
I don't know whose rule it was. I didn't know if I invented it or read about it someplace.
Okay.
It could have been either. When you've read as many books as I have for as long, you kind of get lost, you know? You don't know where you got things. Anyhow, that was my rule. And so if I get stuck, it, my characters were there, you know, and they were set in a place, and they were going toward a certain other place, and they were working, and they were relating to one another, and I had no idea what they were doing. They were talking behind my back. They were conspiring together, and I had no way at all of knowing, and I just had to go do something else for a while. And that's why the little books. So I wrote the first one of the Little Mysteries, A Little Neighborhood Murder. And that was surprisingly part of Doubleday's mystery line in hardcover, which I hadn't intended. You know, I had thought it just would be another one of these little books. And so I had a character there that I pursued through another five books after that, and then I did another one of the Oliphant books that were also mysteries with the Shirley MacLintock character that was a rancher, which is what I was doing at the time. So that one was easy. And those were also picked up. And so it was kind of a, I don't know how to describe it. It was a break. It was like taking a vacation from the big book I was working on at the time.
The sorbet between the different courses of the meal.
Yeah. Clearing the palate. Exactly.
Exactly.
Exactly. That's what it was.
One question I'd like to insert. When you were writing, for example, Little Neighborhood Murder, did you know that Jason Lynx would be an ongoing character at that time?
Heavens, no. No, I had no idea. It wasn't until he came out in hardcover that I had any idea that he might, you know. It was just one of these things that I was doing to fill in. Now, then when I did Shirley MacLintock, I had a pretty good idea because the other one had, so this one probably would too. And I kind of did them intermittently, you know, first one and then the other. And they were fun. They were lots of fun to do.
They're fun to read.
Yeah, and they're lighter, you know, in content. They're not complicated. They're just easier. Yeah, they're fun.
Yeah. Let me ask you something, maybe a bit presumptive, but I'm going to try anyway, because the Jason Lynx are as A.J. Ord, and the MacLintock books are B.J. Oliphant. And you, this goes back to, you know, the history of women writing in, well, and writing anything, where you would have C.L. Moore, or even at one point U.K. Le Guin and all that. So
right.
That the publishers were trying to be gender free in these names. Was that intentional with these two mysteries, even though they
are? Can I tell you exactly how it happened?
Please.
The agent told me you have to have another name. I went to the bookstore. I looked at the books. They were all, it was going to be a mystery. I went to the mystery rack. I went to the science fiction rack first, then to the mystery rack. All the books by authors starting with A were in the upper left-hand corner. All of the books down here, down in the bottom corner with the W, T's, UV's, X's, and so forth. So I looked right in the middle, eye level, and there was lots of M's, and there was lots of N's, and there weren't any O's at all. And I said, that's where I want to be.
Okay.
So that's where Ord and Oliphant came from, and since I didn't have any names for them, I just gave them initials.
Okay.
See, that's terribly serious, and it has very deep implications, doesn't it?
Well, I think it's great. I was just wondering, because I remember when I was doing some interviews with some women who were just breaking through, especially one who was writing a lot of science fiction, but also writing a certain amount of military science fiction, you know, the kind of thing that Bain Books would publish or something like that. And they encouraged her to use her first two initials or in order to have better sales to men.
I think that's very accurate. I think probably that kind of fiction would be very definitely directed toward men.
Yeah, and so whenever...
I don't see any reason that women can't write it, but I feel that men definitely are the ones who read it mostly.
Yeah, and you know, this, you know, so UK Le Guin had written for Playboy magazine, of all things. I don't know if she'll ever live that down. And so whenever I hear of writers, and especially writers who can, you know, be termed as feminist writers, who use the first two initials, I wonder about that sometimes, whether this is a marketing decision, a political decision, or simply an intelligent one.
Or just where you're located on the ship.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, that's the best answer I've ever heard.
Yeah. the people who write to me tend to be women, mostly, and occasionally a guy, and they're always guys that I say, oh, Lord, I'd love to meet him, because they're always such nice guys, you know? And so I don't have a big male readership, and I never really tried to angle toward any particular readership. I just wrote the kinds of things I liked to read. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that explains that.
Although I was at a reading last night where there were a lot of people, and I mentioned that I was going to be interviewing you today, and the eyes of the men lit up as much as the women.
That's wonderful. That's nice. I have quite a big readership in Britain, and a very lovely, lovely editor there who has liked my work and has followed it. And I do get a lot of letters from Great Britain and from Australia. And it's kind of funny because it's just nice.
And the Worldcon just ended in Australia, so that's particularly cool. How do you think your readership is different today than it was 30 years ago?
They've aged, like I have.
Well, I certainly have. I was in my 20s when I first read you, and in my 50s now. But is there a new generation reading you?
And I don't know. I don't know. The ones I get mail from are mostly people my age or just a little younger.
Mm-hmm.
I don't get a lot of mail from very young people. I don't really expect it. I don't think young people correspond the way older people may by letter, you know?
No, I think they
may email. They do. They know email. They know Twitter. They know more than they do writing someone a letter. I think that's kind of a passing thing.
Yeah, that may well be. I wouldn't be surprised at all. A lot of people blog. They read a book, they blog, they belong to things like Goodreads, in which you post what you're reading now, and everybody says, oh, this is wonderful, I'm reading it at the same time. It's sort of like having a nonstop, ongoing book club.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I can imagine that, yes. Mm-hmm.
And it just occurs to me that it's not often that you catch the writer responding directly to their readership in those circles unless they're specifically invited to do so.
Well, some of us have very fragile egos, you know. We don't want to submit ourselves out there to the world.
I can well understand that, being a person who interviews writers.
Uh-huh.
And
I don't want to hear that, honey. If you didn't like it, don't buy it.
Right. But yeah, I am wondering, and this is me wondering more so, I'm just wondering and hoping that there are, you know, teens and people who are the age that you and I were when we started reading, who are reading you now.
Oh, I tell you, I do get letters from mothers asking me where they can get the early books, the King's Blood IV books, the True Game books, because they want to give them to their, you won't believe this, their grandsons.
Right.
I used to get them from mothers who said, I read this to my son. Now I'm getting them from people who want to get hold of the books for their grandsons. And so that's interesting.
That really is.
Yeah.
Hand-me-down fiction.
Uh-huh, exactly.
And long may that last.
I have books on my desk that were my father's.
Yes.
You know, Ernest Thompson Seton books that I read over and over as a child, and I still have them.
Yeah. I would hope so. That's the thing that scares me the most about virtual publishing and Kindle and all that. I think it's a wonderful thing for the portability, but it's not a hand-me-down.
No, you can't give it to anyone. Or you can give them the whole Kindle, I guess.
Yeah, well, yeah, but it's not the same thing. I love reading on these e-readers and things like that. It's very convenient. But then I want the book as well. I want it all. I want to have the testament, the testament to the fact that I've read, endorsed, and loved this book.
Well, I can't get into a book on the screen the way I can on a page. I just can't.
Yeah.
And, of course, I work on a computer all the time now, so I must be doing it while I'm writing it. But I can't really do it with anything else.
Yeah.
I put it on paper.
There's a different experience from the computer screen. I work in computers. There's a different experience doing it in the computer screen and using a dedicated e-reader like the Nook or the Kindle or something like that, mm-hmm. which makes it a lot easier to do. But when you're done, it's insubstantial.
Have you ever considered Hive Noise?
I'm sorry, say again?
Hive Noise. Have you ever visited a bee farm, an apiary?
Ooh, no, only very briefly and many, many years ago.
Well, I am told by bee raisers that if you go and listen to a hive, the hive noise tells you the health of the hive, the noise. It's the buzzing. And it's just the hive noise. That's what it's called. And so now we've got Twitter, and we've got texting, and we've got blogging, and we've got it all over the world, and it's going out into space, and it's traveling, and it's traveling, and it's traveling. And somewhere out there, I think there are apiarists listening for the hive noise. And they'll say, hey, put your ear up next here. What do you hear? Oh, that's hive noise. Yes, it is. And there's no intelligent content. It's ripe for harvest.
Well, to begin with, I love the concept of Twitter and all these things being hive noise. I think it's just fabulous. But there are some wonderful new writers out there, and so I don't want to say there's no one.
They're not writing it on Twitter.
No, they're not. Thank God. There are people who, alas, are trying to write on Twitter, and it's like, no, don't do that. But they're talking about what they're reading on Twitter.
Yeah, that's all right.
And that's a good part of the hive noise.
I think the most depressing information I was ever given is when I, on various jobs that I've had, I have received the same information in training staff or when you're trying to outreach to people. And there's three very important things to remember about people. Number one, they don't read. Number two, they don't read. Number three, they don't read. And I know that's not true because I know people who read. But darn, through life, I have to realize there are an awful lot of people who don't.
Yeah.
They really don't read, you know. You can put a sign right in front of them in letters 4 inches high, red on white, and, oh, I didn't see that.
I know.
So I'm glad there are people who read. There are still people.
There are. And what's more, even in today's virtual society, as it were, going towards that whole what Jack Williamson called, you know, with folded hands kind of society. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, people are reading. The book industry, the publishing industry, is huge. It's doing very well. It's one of those fabulous invalids like theater where everybody says how poorly it's doing, and then all of a sudden you realize how big the players like Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble's. These are huge companies that are, you know, wreaking havoc and doing wonderful and terrible things on the basis of book sales.
That's wonderful. Just wonderful.
So people are reading. Maybe the I think the wrong people, as it were, aren't reading, but that's always been the case.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the ones, of course, that I feel free to make mock of.
Absolutely, and deservedly so. How would you best describe all of your work, you know, regardless of whether you're writing? You've written a lot of nonfiction, you've written some poetry, a couple of short stories. If you were to describe yourself as one, I know most people would just summarize you by saying, oh, she's an eco-feminist. But how would you describe yourself, regardless of genre or theme or whatever?
I'm a preacher.
Ooh.
I'm a preacher. The book is my pulpit.
Okay, I would say...
I have a message here. It's an important message, the first book I wrote. It's still important today. It'll be important 20 years from now. It'll be important 100 years from now. People need to start listening. I'm not the only one preaching it. The form may be different, but there's a message there. There's always a message there. Yes, ecofeminism is the message. Ecology, is very important. People are less conscious of it now than they were immediately following World War II. At that time, they were extremely involved in it. And they were involved at that time in the population issue. And my pulpit is, and my message is very simply, the world is drowning in people. We are destroying our world. And if we don't cut back on population, we are going to destroy our world. And that's what I am. And when people charge me with, you know, being an eco-feminist, sure, yeah, I am. Yeah, I am. Okay. If you don't like the book, don't buy it. If you don't like the church, don't join it.
Yeah, and yet some people would divide those. There are ecologists who are not necessarily feminists and feminists who are not ecologists. Now, some of my best friends, and I would hope to include myself in this, I tend to see the, you know, earth and ecological movement and all that as a very feminine kind of thing, the whole Gaia goddess kind of motif.
Yeah, the whole fruitfulness of nature. Yeah, it definitely is. Sure, it is. And there are societies in which the main goddess is female, and there are societies in which the main deity is both male and female.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think any of that really matters. We just need to take care of our house. You know, we're not cleaning up our house. We're living in a garbage dump. We're not cleaning up our house. We're not being good neighbors. And we should be, and we need to pay attention to that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's sort of hard to watch the garden grow when the garden is polluted.
That's right, exactly. And when you're killing all your neighbors off down in the swamp, it's kind of hard to say, oh, I care about people.
Yeah, so that's a good thing. Now, which brings me to another question, because your writing career at this point has spanned some 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I am hoping that some things have changed for the better, whether they're feminist issues, ecological issues, the environmental outlook. I remember I was a volunteer on Earth Day in 1970. Well, you know, I was still a kid, of course, but at that time, this was just radicalism. And today it's old hat.
Yeah.
And I'm
scared about it being old hat.
I'm hoping it can't be old hat, given what's been going on in the Gulf recently.
Yeah.
I'm for all the disaster that's going on, I'm also hoping that there's some consciousness raising that will come along with it.
But, Jim, it all comes back to one issue, you know. You can clean up the environment all you want to. You can have green revolutions all you want to. There are still millions of people starving, and the only way we're going to stop that is to focus on population.
Mm-hmm.
And that flies in the face of so many religions who think that being fruitful is the only thing that really is important. And there are many religions around the world. I'm not talking about any particular ones here who think that's terribly important, you know, and too many male-dominated religions who think that is the only important thing, and that women's only purpose is to give me sons and daughters to prove how masculine I am. And that's still there, and it's still there in Africa, and it's still there in Asia, and it's still there in the Middle East.
And it's still there in the U.S.
Well, it's still there in some parts of the U.S., yes. And until we get beyond that, past that, until the religions stop trying to push their religious rules into government in order to control sex, we're still going to have it. And it's just, it's sad. You know, we say in the Constitution that the government shall make no rules respecting religion. And yet if you really look at what we have in the way of regulations and so forth, you will see that there's rule after rule after rule after rule respecting religion. Marriage is a religious right. Just look at the controversy, if you don't believe that. Look at it. It's a religious right. There should be no rules respecting marriage. None at all. There should be no rules whatsoever. People wanting to operate, have a relationship and raise children should sign a civil contract saying what they're going to do and what the responsibilities are going to be. And then if they want to have a religious right, they should go have it. But it is the civil contract that should prevail, and that's the only thing that the government should rule on, is the civil contract. Get religion out of government. And I've said this over and over and over for years and years and years, but we don't do it.
Yeah, the, the sad part is that the Constitution says it as well, but then doesn't do it. And there it still
That's
is.
That's right. Yes, yes, the Constitution says it as well. But it sneaks in. You see, they sneak it in under regulations rather than actual laws passed by Congress. So some of those are congressional laws as well.
Yeah. They sneak it in, and there's still no equal rights amendment, which is, to me, just jaw-dropping. We talked a little bit about how ecology and the environmental issues have and have not changed, and the issues regarding control of sex and gender issues over the years. In some ways, feminism has become a far better thing. Women have jobs now that they may not have equal pay in all circumstances, but they're holding important jobs now. They're starting to become a proper part of society, at least more so than was true when, you know, 30 years ago when you began your writing.
That's quite true.
How has that affected your writing today?
Well, you know, until we get four female members on the Supreme Court, it's not going to do a great deal. Because in the areas of decision-making, there's still a big gap. In the areas of decision-making and lawmaking, there is still a big gap. Now, in economic sense, the gap is not so large. But in the decision-making, lawmaking section, there's still a big gap.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to see that one closed before I can say that there's really a change. You see what I'm saying? Upstream, there's a dam still. And we need to get rid of that dam upstream before I can really say that the flow downstream is as good as it ought to be.
Right. And so speaking of streams, that brings us to a title, The Water's Rising. So let's get pragmatic about talking about your new novel. Give us what I sent your publicist an email was a précis. This is a term that Ellen Datlow taught me when I was doing interviews for her. Is, oh, give us a précis of the book. I've always,
okay.
And I've stolen that from her, and I still use it. But, you know, it's like, okay, so what's the book about, you know?
Okay, The Water's Rising. Okay, well, as in many of my books, the world in that book is a post-industrial one. It's a world in which nature has taken over and is slowly recovering from human abuse. It's also a world that is destined to be underwater in about two centuries. Now, I want to say to all the sci-fi purists, I can only say this is a fantasy. It's not pure science. I have given a reason in the book for the flood, which will not stand up to critical investigation, but it stands up nicely as a suppositional base for a story, so just take it as that.
Okay, three words to the, pardon me, three words to those people, get over it.
Okay, all right, so there's one group of humans has preserved and built upon the technological past. Okay, that they've made great advancements upon it in the genetic field. And their aim has been to save the human race when the entire world is underwater. This was the first group who knew it was happening. And the water's rising describes a critical step in that process. And also, a part of the book depends on a character who appeared in a book published back in 1993. That book was called A Plague of Angels.
Mm-hmm.
At the time I was writing that book, Charlie Brown, who was the editor at Locus, was visiting me, and I gave him the manuscript to read. It's a manuscript that had a happy ending. I like happy endings. I mean, as I said earlier, life gives us enough rotten ones. Anyhow, Charlie said at the end of the book the heroine had to die. And I didn't want her to die. That would have left her lover, of whom I was extremely fond, all alone. And you have to submit when there's superior firepower on the other side, and Charlie had a lot of firepower.
Mm-hmm.
So I killed her. And I have felt guilty about it ever since. Now, her lover, Abasio, was out there in the dream world all alone, except for his talking horse. And I decided to atone for that. So The Water's Rising starts out with Abasio and his horse coming back into focus. Now, he meets the heroine, the girl, Shulai, who is destined to bring this survival plan to fruition. Have you ever noticed that fantasy depends a great deal on things that are destined?
Yes.
I have, yeah. Well, in this case, destiny is human-designed and human-intended and human-prayed for, so it's not some abstract
thing. Excellent. I have often said, watching movies and TV and reading books, saying destiny would be a good word to eliminate from the vocabulary when writing your works. But
okay, so Abasio and Shulai obviously have opposition. And they're being opposed by creatures that are left over from a time in the past that's recalled only with the words, the big kill. And at that time, almost every living non-vegetable creature was destroyed on Earth. And they're also pursued by certain humans who possessed machines from that time, which they've been taught to use. And naturally, they're machines of destruction and mass destruction. There's so many of them around right now that some of them are bound to survive for millennia. And that's the basis of the story, and it has a happy ending.
Okay, wait, that's not going to be too much of a spoiler for people.
No.
And I have to admit, I am only about a quarter of the way through the book, but it's so much fun to read.
Well, I hope so. They should be, shouldn't they?
Yeah, no, they absolutely should be. But sometimes, sometimes great books are, ponderous and didactic.
Short word, dull.
Yeah. Sometimes, it depends.
I picked up an award winner the other night that I'd ordered from Amazon, and I put it down, and I said, sorry, I'm too tired, it's dull. I know it's an award winner, I'm sure it's great, but just dull.
Yeah, you're not naming names, though, are you?
No, wouldn't think of it.
Oh, okay, off the air. Hey, I like to dish with the best of them.
I wouldn't think of it. It wasn't science fiction.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't science fiction. Yeah, so you can leave it on. I do read other things.
What are you working on now?
Well, now that's kind of fun. We talked about The True Game, the first ones I ever did back in the 80s.
Right.
Okay.
The Maven Many-Shaped books.
And Maven Many-Shaped, yeah.
Maven, sorry.
Maven Many-Shaped. That's all right. You can pronounce it any way you want to. And we talked about Plague of Angels.
Right.
And now I'm tying up, this next one is called Fish Tales. And it's tying up Plague of Angels and The Water's Rising together with a ship returning from the land of the True Game 1,000 years later.
Ooh, okay.
Okay. It may be the last one I write, so I thought I'd tie everything up in a bundle.
Oh, I certainly hope not.
Well, one never knows, you know.
Yeah, you have such a fabulous body of work, and it's fun to I have to start revisiting it. I mean, I'm remembering so many of these books, and I haven't revisited them myself. You have, and
I've just gotten as far. Last night, I got as far as what did I get up to? I got up to The Awakeners last night, and I didn't remember how it came out.
Oh my!
So it was exciting. Oh, gee, I hope she does a good job with this, you know. No, really, 30 years ago, and I've read an awful lot of stuff since, and I've just forgotten. That's kind of nice.
Yeah, it really is. So I'm going to have fun. Probably by the time I get to broadcast this in a month or so, I will have reread so much of it, and I know I'm going to have fun doing it.
That's good. That's good. I'm glad.
And I love the didacticism. To some people, it may be learning. For me, there's both learning and reinforcement of the way I feel about the world. And one of the wonderful things about the way that you write is that it holds true. A lot of science fiction and fantasy, a lot of genre stuff that is written in a certain era has to be, and of course is reflective of that era.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the best of it just stays true today and becomes timeless.
I hope so. Yeah, it should be. If you've told the truth is the truth, you know, and it should be a truth for the forever, if you've told a real truth. Not just what things are now, but a truth.
Well, I've gotten a lot of truths from you, and I want to thank you for them.
Well, Jim, thank you for the interview. It's been fun.
It's been wonderful.
Okay.
Okay.
Talk to you again later.
Okay, very good.
Sherry S. Tepper, as recorded on September umpteenth, a month ago, and her latest book from EOS, E-O-S, is The Waters Rising. That's no apostrophe, no possessive. This is plural, The Waters Rising. And a rare moment for me, I generally don't like doing phone interviews, but she's not running out of Santa Fe too often anymore. She runs a guest ranch in Santa Fe, and since 80 has come and gone, she's not running around at conventions too much. I have never met her in person. Ken Gale, here of WBAI, apparently had met her at some convention some years
ago.
Yeah,
she was a guest of honor at a convention years ago, and I don't remember which one. It was out of town.
I presume, come to think of it, she must have been guest of honor at any number of them, and I can and deservedly so. And first of all, thanks to EOS Books for setting this up. Oh, I was saying I don't record phone interviews because you don't get the same rapport as sitting in a room. I don't even care to do recorded interviews that much, although I did one yesterday with Richard Kadrey, and I'll be doing one on Tuesday with Noelle Sturgeon, daughter of Theodore Sturgeon.
Ooh.
And the whole Sturgeon family. Oh, we're going to be doing a lot of Sturgeon stuff. I hope you're ready for this, Ken. This is going to be way cool. Any involvement you want, you're welcome. I mean, Sturgeon can't get enough for me.
He is my favorite American writer of the 20th century.
Western, science fiction, or yes to both?
Yes to both. I mean, I'm just talking about writer in general.
He's wonderful.
His ability to use language and his ability to succinctly talk about human relationships.
He brought human relationships and human characters to pulp science fiction. He changed the nature of science fiction from just fiction about ideas and larger-than-life pulp characters of Heinlein and Asimov, and brought in humanity into pulp fiction of the 40s.
I remember reading one of his novels or short stories from the early 50s where he basically wrote about the sexual tension between a male and female character.
Mm-hmm.
And in one paragraph, he just gave what other writers would take pages and pages to do.
Yeah.
And in the early 50s, so there was lots of language you could not use. And but he was clear. There was no subtlety here, except in the subtlety of the language itself. Absolutely wonderful stuff. Yeah. But anyway, we're not here to talk about Theodore Sturgeon.
But we are.
You get me started, I'll talk about him, you know, for hours.
But we are here to mention, among other things, because it's a marathon time, and during Thons, it is time to boast a little. So I'm boasting that I'll be spending Tuesday recording and talking with Noel Sturgeon and plotting and planning with her on things that we will be bringing to the airwaves that are Sturgeon-esque.
Oh, wonderful.
It was approximately a 20-hour marathon reading of Ted Sturgeon's work at ReaderCon, and I was honored. I got to do A Saucer of Loneliness. I kicked the whole thing off by reading that first short story there. It's a favorite short story. When I started at WBAI in 1967, Baird Searles was working with Ted Sturgeon. I met him at that time, and Sturgeon was watching Baird produce A Saucer of Loneliness, A Touch of Strange, The Skills of Xanadu, a lesser-known but not deservedly lesser-known story.
And I'm so bad at story titles, I don't remember which is which.
These are WBAI radio dramas. Seems to me that in the future there's a premium.
Absolutely.
But this morning we have a different premium.
Yes.
This morning we have 10, count them, 10 and no more, autographed copies of Sherry Tepper's new novel.
Wow.
And the EOS Books donated the 10 copies.
So that means they had to send them to her in Santa Fe?
They sent them to her in Santa Fe. They mailed them to her there. She autographed them.
And she had to send them back.
And she sent them to WBAI, where they were received by Mercy. And they are now in the back room here. And for a $75 pledge to WBAI, you can get one of these 10 copies. For a $100 pledge, you can get the interview you just heard on a CD. And I will find a way to fill out that CD with a couple of extras, the CD or DVD extras belonging to the book. It might be it'll be an audio CD, so I'm going to pull a Schmied, in other words, and just fill up that CD with all things Sherry Tepper. But here's the deal, gang. This is my one time on the air during this thon. Preempted next week. I would have been on the week after that, except I will be going away. And I asked the program director, Tony Bates, if he would swap the preemption for me so that I could be on Halloween. And he did that. So my next time on the air is October 30th. It's a long time away.
It is.
And I need to prove that this show is something that y'all value. And that means we need to raise dollars. The station needs to survive. And because I did something that we're not or was really supposed to do, I gave you the show. Normally, there would also be a reading with it. Normally, at this point, I would be reading from this novel. Sherry did read from this novel for us, but the sound quality was just not there. I actually have it with me, but trust, it was done on a cassette machine. It was tinny.
Mm.
But we will find a way to bring all of that to you, possibly even, you know, to fill out that pledge. But
yeah, Max was helping me make a tinny interview less tinny. it can be done nowadays.
Yeah, but this was really off mic and all that. I tried equalizing it. I did stuff, but there's only so much that one can do. But that all that aside, we have nevertheless 10 autographed copies of this book, Sherry Tepper's latest novel. And it is a good one. And $75, it's a bargain.
It's a bargain.
Especially since she doesn't get to very many conventions.
No, you're not going to.
And you're not going to get an autographed anything.
Unless you go
like
to
this.
Unless you go to her ranch in Santa Fe.
So $75 is definitely less than the price of a ticket to Santa Fe.
And most importantly, it goes to support WBAI. And, normally this is the kind of premium being autographed and all that. I don't want to say the resale value on eBay or whatever. You know, it would normally go for like, $150 or something like that. But in consultation with the powers that be, Tony and Kathy, we figured we're going to, shall we say, price them to move. We're not selling this. We're giving it to you for free in exchange for your donation.
Right. And it's $25 for regular membership, and if you give us another $50, you get this book
autographed, and that is a big deal. And the way shut up my phone, the phone that dares speak its name. I keep forgetting to silence it every time I get an email.
Well, that's because this is your first time on the radio.
Oh yeah, right. What was it in January, February? Thank you for that, Tony. Tony's doing ops this morning, and I had
Tony Ryan, not Tony Bates.
Tony Ryan, yes, that's right. And I had the phone in my breast pocket, close to the microphone, and I was eulogizing the wonderful Cage Baker, who had just died of uterine cancer. And I had the phone in my shirt pocket, and as I said the words uterine cancer, it just said its name loudly. Mm-hmm. I'm saying, and Cage Baker was a wonderful writer, and she died of uterine cancer. Droid. And it's like, oh, please, no, that was an inappropriate droid.
212-209-2950.
That is the number to call and pledge your support to WBAI for Hour of the Wolf and for Sherry Tepper and for EOS Books for donating. That's a part of HarperCollins.
I know a lot of you are lying in bed and you've gotten up to Jim Freund and you're really enjoying listening to Sherry Tepper's interview as well you should. But just for a little while, just get up to the phone and call 212-209-2950, and you can go right back to bed afterwards.
This is the only opportunity during this thon to show your support for Skiffy, for Science Fiction Things, this being the Science Fiction Fantasy program of WBAI. And this is the opportunity. And let me boast a little bit. Let's go backwards in time.
Mm-hmm. 212-209-2950.
If you heard last week's show with Karen Lord, you heard one of the most exciting new voices in science fiction. This woman from Barbados who lived in Scotland and studied at Oxford and has a doctorate in astronomy and writes magical stories based on non-magical folk tales from West Africa. The week before that, 2 weeks ago, you heard Nalo Hopkinson, one of the wonderful writers in science fiction, no longer a new voice, but certainly one of the best voices, both read and be interviewed. That was actually the guest of honor interview at ReaderCon, which I was honored to... I was her interviewer at ReaderCon. And then we got a reading through Scott Edelman himself of Marvel Comics. You know Scott Edelman?
I certainly do.
Yeah, so Scott Edelman.
And his wife, Irene Vartanoff.
That's right.
And anybody who read comics in the 60s and 70s knows that name.
Yeah, but it was Scott who gave us the audio.
Mm-hmm.
Scott will be here in two. Maybe I should hook him up with you.
Scott hasn't worked for comics
in
a long time.
Weeks where I'm, yeah, but he's writing zombie fiction and stuff, and he's still wonderful and crazy.
He is.
It's funny. I've known Scott a long time. I didn't know he was in comics. So because he does so many wonderful things. You sort of triangulate and meet him through different ways. The week
I had a birding friend I didn't know was in comics. He was an editor at Marvel, and I had no idea. I knew him from birding, and then one day I'm at a comic convention, and there he is. And he's like, "What are you doing here?" And I'm like, "What are you doing here?" People have many facets.
They really do.
And especially writers, because you need a lot of facets to write well. I think.
And the week before that, we had 9 people in this room from a writer's group, and Kay Tempest Bradford, it was her turn in the barrel, read a fascinating first draft of a short story on the air, where the other people in her writer's group discussed what was good and not good about the
story. That was very interesting, and I'm sure there's got to be a lot of people who want to be published writers. They're probably already writers, but want to be published. And that must have been a wonderful lesson in writing, in editing, and everything else.
So that's just the last...
Absolutely invaluable, that show.
So that's... And a couple of weeks before that, we had a few of the same people from the coincidentally, from the anthology Sybil's Garage. Three people were reading their fiction on the air from that anthology, including Barbara Krasnoff. And so this is just the last 4 shows. Tempest Bradford and crew...
thank you for that
Hawkinson,
call.
Karen Lord, and Sherry Tepper. And this is what I tried to provide on this program. And darn it, I'm proud. And we're going to be doing Sturgeon. I did a really fun interview yesterday with Richard Kadrey. Talk about bizarre zombie stuff. His Sandman Slim books are quite astounding. And look for him in graphic
novels. Well, one of the things I like about your show is that you interpret science fiction very broadly. So you'll have old writers, young writers. You'll have people who write supernatural fiction, people who write hard science fiction, people who write fantasy.
And sometimes it's just mainstream, and I don't care.
And
if it's good.
Yeah.
It will appeal to a certain audience.
It's a great breadth of science fiction, and I think that anybody who listens regularly is going to learn about authors and styles they did not know.
And who did I have before that? Barry N. Malzberg.
Right.
Right. And I'm just going off the top of my head of the last few shows, Live on the Air, one of the greats in science fiction. And we were talking about the definitions and non-definitions of science fiction and all that. And so I am proud. And the thing that gives me the ability to be that proud is the ability to be here at WBAI, which provides the platform for a program such as this to exist. And I ask you to support this program, to support that platform, as 2 people are currently doing, by calling in a pledge to WBAI, 212-209-2950.
And this is for the BAI audience and Simon's audience as well, is that if this was a commercial radio station...
How many ads would you have heard?
You would have heard a zillion ads. They would all have been for movies. They would have mostly been for bad movies.
Mostly.
And they would have... and Jim would have been told.
And last week we were giving away tickets to a movie, which was last night. And it was more than a movie. It was a concert of 300 performers performing the music to Lord of the Rings.
But my point is that
we weren't the only people giving away.
Reading money. Stories would be right out.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you'd have somebody going, well, that's not commercial. You can't read stories. So that would be
and you don't even get,
heavily frowned upon.
And you don't even really get that at other radio stations, including other non-commercial stations. Other non-commercial stations do a very good job of what? 13 shows a year? How many shows a year are Selected Short, Simon?
I think it's a 13.
You know, and it's a wonderful show of very talented actors reading the works of writers. Mm-hmm. And first of all, it's rarely genre.
Oh, yes, rarely.
Rarely genre.
And even when it is, they don't want to acknowledge it.
No, they will occasionally.
Well, occasionally.
Because they do so at symphony space. Because
I've heard science fiction stories that I would say, you know, there's all kinds of speculation in this. And they don't call it science fiction. It's a romance or whatever.
They're generally not on selected shorts. And then it's still it's not the author's voice. Now, admittedly, actors can be better, but they don't get that authentic voice of what the author is writing, what the author is saying. We have 10 autographed copies, speaking of authors, of Sherry S. Tepper's new novel, The Waters Rising, put together for WBAI by the publisher, mailed to New Mexico so she could autograph them, and sent back to WBAI. I don't know how many have gone. I suspect it may only be two, possibly three. But we have another 15 minutes in which to move.
Well, that's plenty of time to get eight calls.
It is. But it's not going to happen again for this thon. I'm going to be back on October 30th and with a very different show, and this will not be available then. This is the one and only chance to do it. 212-209-2950. Make that call.
$75 for an autographed copy of Sherry Tepper's book. A very thick book, I should add. It definitely will give hours and hours of enjoyment.
And 498 pages.
And for another $25, so it's a $100 pledge, you get a copy of the interview that Jim did with her.
And whatever I can fill out that CD with. there will be things possibly even a reading. Can't guarantee that yet, but we're working on getting a reading. 212-209-2950. Another call has come in. Thank you very much. I suspect that means four copies gone, six copies left. This is a bona fide, this is it. The books were, BAI didn't go out and buy these books. They were donated by the publisher. They were sent by the publisher to the author. The author sent them back to sent them around to WBAI. They are on the premises here. Once they are gone, they are gone. Another call is coming
in. Sure
that means five copies.
And I'm now surprised from my fleeting meeting with her and also her, just the way she spoke with you that, she'd be nice enough to bother to do that.
Oh, she was lovely.
And
it was very, there's a very interesting.
It's the kind of person you want to support and whose work you want to read.
Yeah.
And immerse yourself in.
Yeah, and as I was saying in the interview, her didacticism on ecological issues and all that is fascinating and wonderful. Her politics are her own, and given her upbringing on.